be the wiser. They call them ghost cars. Any rate, next day I phoned the S.O. and had one of the deputies read off the vehicle identification number from Violet's Bel Air.
You had that?
Oh, sure. Chet Kramer gave it to us in one of the early interviews. I called up the Sacramento DMV and had them do a computer search. They show no record of the VIN. Dang. For a minute I was hoping for a hit, but the cars never surfaced, which sets me back to the notion it was shipped overseas.
You're assuming the number Kramer gave you was correct, I said. All he had to do was alter one digit, and the computer would have spit it back as a no match.
That's a troubling possibility. You'll be careful.
I will.
And keep me in the loop.
I assured him I'd be doing that as well.
I stopped at a delicatessen and picked up some sandwiches and cokes, then took Highway 166 out of Santa Maria until it intersected New Cut Road. By now the route was familiar, and I drove with only half my attention focused on the road. With the balance of my mental energy, I was sifting through the miscellany I'd collected over the past 2 days. I wasn't much wiser, but at least I was getting all the players sorted out. I reached the Ottweiler property at 11:15. Tanny's contractor had arrived early, and he pulled into the driveway the same time I did. She introduced him as Bill Boynton, one of the two Paget had suggested the night before. I told her about the sandwiches I'd brought and then left her alone to chat with him while I took the opportunity to tour the interior of the house. From the porch, I could see two guys working at the edge of the property, cutting heavy brush as she had. A swath had now been cleared from the foundation to the depth of the yard. The ground looked naked and apologetic, without all the high weeds, brambles, and old shrubs. Even at first glance, I'd found myself agreeing with Paget, who considered the place beyond redemption. No wonder her brother was urging her to sell. The first floor had all the charm of an inner-city tenement. I could see touches of former splendor, 10-inch crown molding, beautifully plastered ceilings with ornate medallions, and cornices as delicate as cake icing. But in most rooms, decades of leakage and neglect had taken their tolls. When I reached the stairs, I began to pick up the acrid scent of charred wood, and I knew that the floors above would be damaged not only by the fire, but by the water from the firemen's hoses. I went up, following a once beautiful oak banister that was now dingy with soot and age. A fine layer of broken glass crunched underfoot, making my progress audible. Fixtures had been stripped. In the largest of the bedrooms at the front of the house, I was momentarily startled by what appeared to be a vagrant curled up in one corner. When I moved closer, I could see that the body was an old sleeping bag, probably left by a drifter taking shelter uninvited. In the large walk-in linen closet, I could still see labels written in pencil on the edges of the shelves, single sheets, double sheets, pillowcases, where the maids had been directed to place the freshly laundered linens. The third floor was inaccessible. Yellow caution tape had been stretched across what was left of the stairs. Gaping holes in the stairwell traced the course of the fire as it ate its way through the rooms above. There was something unbearably creepy about the ruin everywhere. I returned to the second floor and made a circuit, pausing at many of the windows to take in the view. Aside from the field across the road, there wasn't much to see. One field over, a new crop of some kind was sprouting through layers of plastic sheeting that served to keep the weeds down. The illusion was of ice. Closer to the house, Tanny's battle with the brush had uncovered meandering brick paths and a truck garden now choked with weeds. During the summer, a volunteer tomato plant had resurrected itself, and it sprawled over a wooden bench, red cherry tomatoes in evidence like little red ornaments on a Christmas tree. I could see the outlines of former flower beds and trees stunted by lack of sun for all the overgrowth. To the left, at an angle, I gazed down at an ill-defined depression that might have been a sunken pool or the remnant of an old septic system. There wouldn't have been sewer lines in place in the early 1900s when the house was built. A mound of newly cleared snowball bushes was visible along one edge.
The uprooted plants boasted once bright blue blossoms, as big as heads of cabbage. I felt bad at the sacrifice of bushes that had grown so impossibly grand. In the side yard of the lot where our trailer had sat, my aunt had planted hydrangeas much the same color, though not quite so lush as these had been. The neighbor's hydrangeas were a washed-out pink, and Aunt Jin took delight in her superior blooms. The secret, said she, was burying nails in the soil, which somehow encouraged the shift from pink to the rich blue shade. Afterward, I felt I'd been incredibly dense, taking as long as I had to add that particular 2+2. I stared down at the cracked and slightly sunken oblong of soil and felt a flash, the sudden gelling of facts that hadn't seemed connected before. This was where Winston had last seen the car. Amid dirt mounds, heavy equipment, and orange plastic cones, he'd said. A temporary road barrier had been erected, denying access to through traffic. No sign of Violet, no sound from the dog. But from that night forward, the Bel Air was never seen again. Perhaps because it was buried here. Maybe all these years the rich blue hydrangeas had been feeding on the rust. Chapter 20. I drove to the service station near Tullis and used the pay phone to call Schaefer. I told him what had occurred to me and asked how we might confirm or refute my hunch about the oblong depression in the earth. Schaefer was dubious, but said he had a friend who owned a metal detector. He agreed to call the guy. If the guy could help, they'd meet us at the property as soon as possible. Failing that, he'd drive out on his own and assess the situation. I hadn't told Tanny what I was up to, but now that I'd set the wheels in motion, I worried I was making a colossal ass of myself. On the other hand, oh well. There are worse things in life, and I've been guilty of most. By the time I pulled up at the house again, she'd finished her business with Bill Boynton, and he was gone. "Where'd you disappear to? I thought we were having lunch." "Yeah, well, something's come up. I want you to take a look." "Can't we eat first and then look?" "This won't take long." She followed me to the side yard, and I pointed to the irregular rectangle that had attracted my attention. At ground level, the depression wasn't as defined as it appeared from above, especially with half-dead hydrangea bushes piled to one side. At close range, it looked more like a mole had been tunneling across the yard. The soil was uneven, but it took a bit of squinting to see that it was sunken in relation to the surrounding lawn. This was about the same as staring at the night sky trying to identify Taurus the bull by visualizing lines between stars. I never saw anything remotely resembling livestock, a failing I attributed to my paltry imagination. Yet here I was, pointing like a bird dog, saying, "Know what that is?" "Dirt?" "Better than dirt. I think it's Violet Sullivan's grave." Tanny stared down at her feet. "You're shitting me." "Don't think so, but we'll find out." We sat on the porch steps waiting for Tim Schaefer. Tanny had lost her appetite, and neither of us was in the mood to talk. "But I got dibs on the Braunschweiger once we get around to the sandwiches," she said. At 1:10, Schaefer drove up in his 1982 Toyota and pulled into Tanny's drive with his metal-detecting pal. The two got out, car doors slamming in unison, and crossed to the porch. Schaefer carried a shovel and a long steel implement like a walking stick with a point on one end. He introduced his friend, whose name was Ken Rice, adding a two-line bio so we'd know whom we were dealing with. Like Schaefer, he was a man in his early 80s, retired after 38 years with the Santa Maria Police Department, working first as a motorcycle officer, then foot patrol, narcotics, and later as the department's first canine officer. For the past 20 years, his passion had been the location and recovery of buried relics, caches of coins and other forms of treasure. We shook hands all around, and then Rice turned on his detector, which looked like the two halves of a toolbox, connected by a metal rod. "Let's see what we got," The four of us trooped across the property to the side yard, me tagging behind Rice like a little kid. How does that work?
System has a directional transmitter and directional receiver built into these interlocking cases. Powered up, it emits an electromagnetic field that penetrates the soil. This is the same equipment used by public utility employees looking for pipes underground. When the search pattern encounters metal, the signal is interrupted, and that generates an audio response.
How far down?
The fissure's capable of revealing a target as far down as 20 feet. Depending on soil mineralization and ground conditions, it's possible to detect an object even deeper.
When we reached the spot, the three of us watched as Rice swept the detector across the ground. He'd put on a headset, and I gathered the device made a continuous sound that grew louder when he made a find. On his first pass, I saw the needle on the gauge leap hard to the right and stay there as though glued. He pressed a hand to his ear, frowning to himself as he continued sweeping across the area. Having finished, he said,
"You've got something the size of a boxcar down there."
I laughed. "We do?
Schaefer tells me you're looking for a car, but this might be something else."
"Such as what?"
"A dumpster? Underground storage tank? Chunk of sheet metal roof."
"So, now what?" I asked.
"That's what I'm trying to figure out."
He and Schaefer conferred, and then Schaefer returned to his car where he opened the trunk. He came back bearing a ball of twine and a plastic bag full of golf tees he used in recaning chairs. While Rice made a series of passes with his box, Schaefer followed in his wake and stuck golf tees in the ground, roughly conforming to the signal Rice was picking up. Tanny and I each took a turn listening, passing the headset from one to the other. If Rice moved the device too far left or right, the tone diminished. Schaefer ran a line of twine from tee to tee. When they finished mapping, the string was laid out in a rectangle 18 feet long by approximately 8 feet wide. I could feel the skin pucker on my arms at the notion of an underground object of that size. It must be equivalent to sailing on the ocean and realizing a whale was on the verge of surfacing under your boat. The very proximity seemed ominous. Unseen and unidentified, it radiated an energy that had me edging away. Schaefer picked up the metal bar he was using as a probe. He chose a spot and pushed down, leaning his weight into the rod. It sank 8 inches, but not easily. The soil in this part of the state has a high clay content, larded with numerous rocks and sizable sandstone boulders. This makes digging tedious under the best of circumstances. Strike a boulder with a shovel blade and the impact will reverberate all the way up your arms. Rice added his weight to the job. The probe sank another foot and a half and stopped. He said,
"What do you think?
Let's see if it's rock or we're hitting something else."
Schaefer took his shovel and set to work, cutting into the hard-packed topsoil. I'd thought the ground would yield, but it proved to be slow-going. 20 minutes of steady effort produced a trench 18 inches wide and about 3 feet long. Frail roots were exposed and hung from the perpendicular sides of the cut like a living fringe. The dirt pile beside the hole mounted. At a depth of 26 inches, he made contact with an object, or a portion of an object. The four of us paused to stare.
"I've got a trowel if you want to dig by hand," Tanny said.
"Might be smart," Rice replied.
When she returned, she said,
"May I?"
Schaefer said,
"Have at it. It's your land."
Tanny got down on her hands and knees and began to scrape away the dirt. The object might have once been chrome, though it was so badly rusted it was difficult to tell. I found myself tilting my head, saying, "What is that?" By the time she dug down and cut an additional 5 inches, she'd uncovered something with a metal lip that extended over a shallow curve of glass. She looked up.
"It's a headlight, isn't it?"
Schaefer rested his hands on his knees and leaned closer.
"I believe you're right."
Tanny scraped away another narrow trough of dirt, revealing what looked to be the rusted metal curve of a front right fender. Rice said. One of us better call the station and get some help out here.
By 3 o'clock, there were 8 officers at the site, an ID detective, and a young deputy from the Santa Maria Sheriff's Department, a sergeant, 2 homicide detectives, and 2 non-sworn officers from Santa Teresa. In addition, an investigator had driven up from the state crime lab, which is located in Colgate near the Santa Teresa airport. A temporary parking area had been set up for official vehicles, including the crime scene van. The first officer on the scene, the young Santa Maria deputy, had secured the area, relegating Schaefer, Ken Rice, Tanny, and me to a spot 25 yards away. Anyone in a secured crime scene is considered the same as a primary witness and might be asked to testify in court, which is why we were kept at such a distance. In addition, if this turned into a homicide investigation, there was always the risk that unauthorized persons might contaminate the site. The lead investigator, Detective Nichols, came over and introduced himself, then briefed us on strategy for the excavation. He was a good-looking man in his 40s, wearing a dress shirt and tie, with a windbreaker but no sport coat. He was slim, his light brown hair trimmed short. He glanced in my direction.
"You're Miss Milhone?"
"That's right.
Could I speak to you?"
"Of course." We moved some distance away so we could talk in private.
"I understand Daisy Sullivan hired you to find her mother. You want to tell me how you came up with this?"
he asked, indicating the site.
I backtracked, filling him in on my conversation with Winston and the tidbit he'd given me about spotting the car. I told him I'd been bothered by the fact that after that last sighting, the car was never seen again. I was touring the house, and when I looked down from one of the second-floor windows, I spotted the depression in the ground. At first I thought I was looking at an old planting bed, but then the car popped into my head. I called Sergeant Schaefer, and he drove out with Ken Rice.
You had no information in advance?
None. In fact, I had only the dimmest recollection of Violet Sullivan's disappearance. I'd read the occasional newspaper account, but I hadn't paid much attention until Daisy contacted me this past Monday. Tanny was the one who introduced us, which is how I ended up here. He settled a look on me that was friendly enough, but had a no-nonsense undertone.
Anything else you find, you make sure I hear about it first.
Absolutely.
We returned to the others. The 5 of us watched while one of the ID techs photographed the area, while the other tech took measurements and drew a rough sketch depicting what was believed to be the angle and orientation of the car. Given what they could see in the early phases of the work, the speculation was that whoever engineered the burial had used a bulldozer with an 8-foot blade, probably creating a ramp at a 20-to-30-degree angle. The car had been backed into the hole and then covered with fill. According to calculations, it would have taken approximately 50 feet of ramp to a maximum depth of 15 feet in order to get the whole of the car underground with the front end sunk deep enough to prevent discovery. Now I could see what that pesky high school geometry class was about. There was no point in going to all the trouble of burying a car if the hood ornament was going to wash clear in the first big rainstorm. If the job were poorly done, the car would emerge, little by little, over a period of time until it looked like an island in the middle of the lawn. Assuming the whole of the vehicle was there, maybe we were looking at the bisected front end with nothing else attached. Detective Nichols excused himself and went back to the dig. If speculation about the depth and angle was correct, the car was tilted beneath the surface, like a sunken submarine, hung up on an underwater shelf. That being the case, the roof of the car and the top edge of the windshield would be approximately 2 paces back and some 2.5 feet deep. To test the theory, Nichols whistled the young deputy over, handed him the shovel, and directed him to dig. He set to work, keeping his cuts shallow. 15 minutes later, the blade of his shovel scraped the surface of the roof. There was a long debate about the use of an excavator, a motion that was quickly ratified. The idea of freeing the vehicle by hand was out of the question.
The ID detective radioed, and a deputy was dispatched to AOK Heavy Equipment to ask Paget if he had one available. This generated an additional delay while the excavator was located, loaded on a low-boy flatbed truck, and driven out from town. Tanny and I retired to her car, now parked 100 yards down the road. We sat with the windows rolled down and ate our deli sandwiches, calling it lunch, though it was already 4 p.m. I had no idea how word got out, but a trickle of people appeared, and before long the road was lined with vehicles. Two deputies controlled public access to the scene, which had been sealed off with tape. Steve Ottweiler arrived, and he joined us, talking to his sister through the open window of her car. She said, "Does Pop know?" "I called him, and he's on his way out. Let me see what Tim Schaefer has to say. He'll know more than we do." Steve crossed the road. Schaefer was standing in a small knot of men. During the course of their conversation, the flatbed truck arrived. Tom Paget had followed in his car, and he supervised the offloading of the compact John Deere excavator, after which the equipment operator was the only one allowed in the magic circle. Paget was relegated to the sidelines in the same way we were, which seemed to annoy him no end. For the next hour, we watched in amazement as the operator maneuvered his equipment with the delicacy of a surgeon. He was directed by whistles and hand signals, his skill such that he could scrape as little as an inch or as much as a foot of dirt from the hole on command. Ken Rice found a ride home while Schaefer remained. He stood sipping coffee from a styrofoam cup someone managed to provide. Even retired, he was drawn to the drama unfolding before our eyes. Jake Ottweiler pulled up and parked his car down the road. His son walked out to meet him, and the two returned to Tim Schaefer's side. Having worked for the sheriff's department for 30-some-odd years, he was the reigning civilian expert. I noticed B.W. McPhee was on hand, having appeared at some point. I also caught a glimpse of Winston, but didn't have a chance to make eye contact before he disappeared again. A local TV station sent a crew, and Detective Nichols gave a brief, uninformative statement, essentially referring the reporter to the sheriff for further comment. At 5:45, Daisy arrived. Tanny and I got out of the car and waved her over. She joined us, looking pale and subdued. She was still in her work clothes, navy slacks, a cotton sweater, and sensible low-heeled shoes. She was chewing on her thumbnail again, but lowered her hand self-consciously when she caught sight of me. She tucked her fingers out of sight, shifted from foot to foot as though to warm herself. She hadn't heard about my tires being slashed, so we talked about that just to get her mind off what was going on.
"I don't like the sound of it."
"It's a bit melodramatic, but I took it as a good sign," I said.
"What are your plans for tonight?"
"I was expecting to head home, but now I think I'll hang out until we know what we've got down there."
"You can't go back to the Sunbonnet."
"No, but there are other motels."
"Spend the night at my place. Tanny leaves first thing tomorrow morning. You'll survive one night on the couch. I've done it before myself. Meanwhile, we can lock your car in my garage and get it off the street in case the son of a bitch comes looking for it."
"If I stay, I'll either need to do laundry or borrow some underwear."
"We'll do both."
"This is such guy stuff, I love it," Tanny remarked, taking in the various gatherings of men. Detective Nichols joined Tim Schaefer on the far side of the road, introducing himself to Jake and Steve Ottweiler. After a few more minutes of conversation, Nichols returned to us. He knew by then that the Ottweilers owned the property, and that Daisy was the only child of the missing Violet Sullivan. He introduced himself to Daisy, and I could see her taking him in. Glasses, clean-shaven, nice smile. There was a shift in her posture. Clearly, she found him attractive. He glanced at the clusters of onlookers out by the road. Even with their limited line of sight, there was something compelling about the work. "I'm about to have the deputies clear these people out of here. This is not a spectator sport. If we need to bring in additional equipment or manpower, I don't want to have to work around all the looky-loos and parked cars.
I'm going to have you give the deputy contact numbers in case I need to get in touch. I'd appreciate your keeping quiet about anything you've seen or heard. We don't want details getting out. The less information we have in circulation, the better.
It's all right if we stay? Daisy asked.
As long as you do what you're told and keep out of the way.
How long will it take? I know you can't say exactly.
I'm guessing 2 days. No point being hasty and damaging the car beyond what nature's already done.
But you haven't found anything?
Not so far. I understand your concern about your mother, and I'll keep you informed. As soon as we free the car, we'll take it to the impound lot. We've got a storage facility where we can warehouse the vehicle while we go over it. Right now, we have no idea what evidence we'll find, if any, after all this time. What about your father? Have you talked to him? Daisy shook her head.
I came right from work. I assume somebody's called him by now, but maybe not. I'm sure he'd be here if he knew.
One thing I'll need to ask him, or maybe this is something you can tell me yourself. Do you recall what your mother was wearing the day she disappeared?
A sundress. Lavender cotton with white polka dots. Leather sandals and thin silver bracelets. 6 of them. I don't actually remember any of it. It was in the report my father filed at the time.
She seemed so tense. I expected her teeth to chatter.
Are you going to tell me if she's down there?
I'll do that, of course. You have a right to know.
Thank you. I'd appreciate that.
As he walked away, she tracked his departure with a calculating eye.
Well, he's cute. Married, no doubt.
Tanny laughed. Just your kind of guy. Too bad he works. He'd be perfect for you. Within minutes, we could see 2 deputies encouraging bystanders to move on. People began to drift away. Car doors slammed, engines coughed to life, and one by one the crowd dispersed. In truth, at that remove, there wasn't much to see. The excavation was being treated like an archaeological dig, sketched, diagrammed, measured, photographed, and documented with a video camera as well. 2-man teams were set up, and as each scoop of dirt was freed, it was loaded into one of 2 sieves, shaken and sifted for physical evidence. At dusk, portable generators were brought in, and high-intensity lights were set up. By then, Daisy was shivering. I linked my arm through hers. Let's get out of here. They're not going to find anything tonight. You're freezing, and I'm starving. Plus, I got to pee so bad, I'm about to wet my pants.
Oh, me too, Tanny said.
Chapter 21. Jake, Thursday, July 2nd, 1953. Jake Ottweiler drove into Santa Maria for his bi-monthly haircut, pausing outside the barbershop to put a nickel in the vending machine and extract a copy of the Chronicle. In his truck, he discovered Mary Harrell's soiled nightgowns in a bundle on the front seat, where he'd inadvertently left them the night before. Once he got home, he'd do a load of wash and take her fresh clothes on his visit the next day. He usually went afternoons or evenings without fail, but she'd urged him to take a day off. He'd argued the point, but more as a way of disguising his relief than with any desire to prevail. As for the laundry, she'd insisted the hospital gowns were fine, not wanting to make more work for him when he was already strapped for time. But he'd seen how much happier she was in her own cotton nightie and robe. Now and then, she even managed to put on her slippers and venture down the hall to visit the pastor's mother, who was laid up with a broken hip. Rudy greeted him when he entered the shop. He was finishing up a shave on the fella ahead of him, so Jake waited his turn. He took a seat in the barber chair. Rudy wrapped a paper band around his neck and then secured a cape over his shoulders. The 2 scarcely exchanged a word. Rudy had been cutting his hair for the past 27 years and didn't need advice. Jake flapped open the paper, skimming for information about the coming 3-day weekend. He wasn't much interested in the 4th of July fol-de-rol, but Mary Harrell wanted the kids to enjoy themselves. Steve was old enough to entertain himself, which in fact he preferred to do.
But Tanny was another matter. Jake thought he might take her to the annual 4th of July rodeo parade in Lompoc, where the Santa Maria Valley Roping and Riding Club would be performing. His choices for the fireworks show were the Elks Field at 8:30 Saturday night, or the little park in Silas, which was closer to home. He planned to take a picnic supper. He didn't know how to cook, but his thought was to buy some hot dog buns and weenies that he could roast on one of the charcoal barbecue grills that dotted the park. He could buy potato salad and baked beans at the market, and maybe candy bars for dessert. As he flipped past the society news, Livia Kramer's name caught his eye. Mrs. Livia Kramer had been the hostess of a home demonstration party at which prizes had been given to Miss Juanita Chalmers, Miss Miriam Berkeley, Mrs. R. H. Hudson, and Mrs. P. T. York. Refreshments of pizza pie and cake were served. Now, why that was newsworthy was beyond him, but he knew she'd be full of herself at the attention. Livia was pretentious enough as it was. He was tempted to carry the article up to the hospital to Mary Harrell, but if he tried poking fun at the woman, Mary Harrell would only come to her defense. Livia was panting for the day when she could palm off that hulking child of hers on some poor unsuspecting chump. With all the prattling about the engagement party, bridal showers, the wedding, the reception, talk of the gown, the flowers, and the honeymoon details, Livia would have her name and likeness splashed across the society pages for a year and a half, assuming anyone would have the girl. He read the comics, Nancy, Freckles, Gordo, and Alley-Oop, which he never thought were funny but couldn't bear to miss. Then he checked the baseball scores and farm news while Rudy ran the clippers up the back of his neck. He drove home smelling like talcum powder. Despite Rudy's best efforts, his back and neck were already feeling itchy from the newly trimmed hairs that had slipped down his collar. Once home, he stripped off his work boots, Sears shirt, and overalls, and ran water in the shower. While he waited for the hot water to come through, he put his clothes in the hamper, and as he passed the bathroom mirror, he glimpsed the scabbed-over claw marks Violet Sullivan had left on his back not 4 days before. He stepped into the shower, feeling both appalled and aroused. If anyone else saw the marks, his goose would be cooked. He was always surprised by the damage she managed to inflict. She was small, no bigger than a girl, all energy and sass, red hair hanging halfway down her back, with a waviness that made a pattern when he lifted it from her neck. He liked to thread his fingers through its thickness, grab a fistful of hair, and pull her head back so hard her mouth would come open with surprise. He'd run a rough palm across her breasts and down the length of her spine while she shuddered with desire. He'd never known a woman like her, so savage and so insatiable. She wore a delicate violet perfume, her trademark, she said. She dressed in purple and lavender, sometimes a dark, vivid green that set her green eyes afire. The fabrics were soft and clung to the front of her legs, making a crackling sound when he pulled the skirt away from her thighs. He'd never cared for violets himself, weeds, to his way of thinking, taking over the lawn. Mary Harrell loved them, the white ones in particular, and she fussed at Jake every time he threatened to spray. He couldn't see the point in letting something wild and uncontrollable encroach on the grass. That spring, which he knew now would be Mary Harrell's last, he'd lain face down among the violets, letting the light, sweet scent saturate his skin. He'd run his hands across the dark green leaves, snatching up the blossoms in much the same way he'd torn into violet the last time they met. The motel carpeting had a strange metallic smell that he associated with their sex. At the hospital the night before, he'd found himself ruminating on the differences between the two women. Of late, Mary Harrell's eyes had begun to look sunken, hollow, smudged dark, and Jake felt as guilty as if he'd struck her. He'd been patient and tender, dogged in his attentions, but his brain had disconnected, returning to Violet, in spite of his best intentions. While he'd dabbed Mary Harrell's face with a damp cloth, he'd be thinking about Violet, the last time they'd been to bed, the ferocity with which she bit and sucked at him, clinging like a woman drowning among the bedsheets. She could tease, withhold, letting her red hair sweep over his thighs while he struggled for control, thrusting himself toward her. Violet would pull away, smiling, her eyes glittering. She'd lick the length of him, and he knew he'd never learn to stifle his groan when she finally took him in her mouth. He looked down. Mary Harrell had asked for ice water, which Jake went to fetch for her, replenishing her glass. She was thirsty, as trusting as a child, sucking at the clear bent glass straw that he held to her lips. She murmured a thank you and lay back against the pillows. He knew he couldn't go on with Violet. Every other day he'd decide he had to break it off, but each time the opportunity presented itself, he'd think, once more, just once more, and then he'd hope to find the strength necessary to sever the relationship. There was a weight in his chest, a heaviness reminding him of all he'd betrayed. Sometimes the anxiety was so intense, he felt sick. He was grateful to Violet. He'd always be grateful for what he'd learned. She'd brought him to life after years of ministering to Mary Harrell's pain. If Mary Harrell would go, if she'd only get on with it, he knew the suffocating sense of desperation would pass. At the same time, though he could barely admit it to himself, he harbored the fantasy that, with his wife gone, Violet might become a permanent part of his life, filling the void that Mary Harrell had left. He turned off the shower knobs with a screech, stepped out, and then dried himself off. He dressed, pulling on the jeans he'd hung on a peg behind his closet door. He picked up the bundle of Mary Harrell's soiled nightclothes and moved into the mudroom, where he'd hooked up the washer and dryer. He opened the washer lid and found himself staring down at the tight coil of wet clothes he'd neglected to move. He couldn't remember running a load. But when he pulled out the first article, he realized it was Mary Harrell's laundry from the week before. The clothes were still damp and now smelled of mildew because the garments had sat so long. How could he have done such a thing? Bringing Mary Harrell clean clothes was something he'd taken on to demonstrate his care and concern. She'd never mentioned the fact that he'd failed to return her nighties and her step-ins. What had she worn all week? Face burning, he started the load again, adding this week's clothing to the one before, hoping that a strong dose of soap powder would eliminate the rank odor of wet cotton gone sour. He went into the bedroom and opened Mary Harrell's dresser drawer, relieved to see she had plenty of other nighties. Everything was neatly folded, a plain virginal white. He pulled out four nightgowns and piled six pairs of step-ins on top. He hesitated, and then laid the pile on top of the dresser. He went through the remaining drawers searching her belongings, something he'd never dreamed of doing before this moment. He wasn't sure what compelled him to forage among her things. Perhaps some morbid curiosity about the personal effects it would soon be his job to pack up and give away. What did he hope to find? A dildo? Evidence of some hidden vice? Drink, kleptomania, pornography? He knew, without having to look, that the dresses hanging in her closet were washed colorless, starched and fastidiously ironed. Why did this generate such anger in him? Why was his life filled with degradation, while hers was so barren and apologetic? In the second drawer from the bottom, hidden under her cotton slips, he saw the corner of a bright yellow box. He moved the slips aside. The drawer was lined with unopened gift sets of Jean Eté after-bath splash and cologne. He couldn't remember the last time he'd thought of giving her anything else. Why would he? Birthdays, she always asked for Jean Eté. He thought she loved it. Opening his gift, which he inevitably prevailed on the clerk to wrap,
She'd seemed pleased and surprised, her appreciation sounding so heartfelt that he hadn't thought to question her sincerity. Christmas meant nothing to him. They gave gifts to the children, but the exchanging of gifts between the two of them felt awkward, so now they skipped the practice on mutual agreement, or so he'd assumed. Seeing the Jeannette, he was deeply ashamed. He'd been complacent about her, so oblivious that it hadn't occurred to him to give her anything more personal, lavish, or spontaneous. He was embarrassed that she hadn't felt comfortable telling him the truth, that she'd thought so little of herself, she hadn't been able to ask for what she wanted. She probably didn't even know what that was. By her birthday, which would fall on September 12th, she'd be gone. And in a flash it occurred to him that if he'd betrayed the marriage, so had she. The difference was that she'd die, being thought of as saintly and good, and he'd be forced to live on without her, burdened by rage, corruption, and guilt. He might be a man without character, but she was a woman without courage. Of the two, which was worse? Once the laundry was done, he left the house and drove to Serena Station. It was only 10:35 in the morning, but BW opened the Blue Moon at 9. There was no explanation for the absurdity of the hour. The place sat empty most of the day, half dark, door open, as cool and welcoming as a church. He parked and went in. At a table to one side, Winston Smith sat by himself, his back to the bar, his expression withdrawn. He had a Miller beer in front of him, though Jake knew for a fact he wasn't legally of age. Given his dark mood, maybe BW had taken pity on the boy, figuring he'd take his chances with the ABC agent who'd been in the week before. Jake took a seat at the bar, and BW set a Blatz in front of him. Jake knew Violet stopped by 2 and 3 times a week after Foley left for work. He hadn't seen her since Sunday, but he needed to talk to her before he lost his resolve. Sure enough, she walked in 20 minutes later. Winston, in the process of ordering another beer, turned and stared at her sullenly. "I need to talk to you." Violet paused by his table. "So, talk." "Please join me," he said. He was speaking with care, but Jake noticed that his consonants had turned soft around the edges. Violet sat down. Whatever Winston had to say to her, he kept his voice low, and Violet's expression never registered more than bemusement. Finally, she leaned forward. Her reply was inaudible, but whatever she'd said, Winston seemed taken aback. She got up and moved to the far end of the bar. Winston said, "Bitch," to himself. Jake looked from the boy to BW. "What's his deal?" BW glanced at Winston.
"Kid lost his job."
BW moved to Violet's end of the bar. She ordered, and Jake watched while BW poured her a glass of red wine. Jake picked up his beer, walked the length of the bar, and took the stool next to hers. He waited until BW put the wine glass in front of her.
"I'll take care of it," Jake said.
BW went to the cash register and punched in the charge, adding it to his tab, then disappeared into the back room to leave the two of them alone. Jake had thought he'd feel anxious about what he had to do, but he found himself regarding her with fondness.
"I thought I'd see you yesterday afternoon."
"Something came up. I had business to take care of."
"I wasn't complaining."
"It sure sounded like that to me. If you're here to whine, don't bother. I already had a big dose of self-pity from Winston."
"Why is he so mad?"
"Because he's a jerk. Know what he said? He wanted me to lend him the money for his college tuition. Can you picture it? The nerve."
I said, "Why would I do that? What do I look like, a damn bank manager? I wouldn't lend you a dime if my life depended on it, you little creep." "You're always talking about your money. Maybe he thought you'd be willing to help."
"Yeah, well, any money I have is mine, and I'm not giving it away. So what are you doing here?"
"We need to talk."
"That's what he said. About what?"
Jake lowered his voice. "I know you've been pulling away. It's been going on for weeks, and it's okay.
I don't want you to feel bad. That's all I want to say. It's probably for the best, and so be it. Violet's tone was flat.
I don't have a clue what you're talking about.
Feels to me like you've gone and found someone else.
What if I have? I can't count on you, that's for damn sure.
You've got Mary Harrell, and I'm out here in the cold trying to look after myself. I need to get the hell out of Dodge, and what do you have to offer? Nothing. A big fat zero.
I'm not blaming you, I swear. I know I don't have anything to offer, and I'm sorry about that, because I'd help if I could.
I guess the best we can say is we never made each other any promises.
She turned and squinted at him.
Wait a minute. What is this? Are you breaking it off?
He motioned a palm flat against the air, trying to get her to lower her voice.
I'd just like to be a good husband to Mary Harrell in whatever time she has left. You think I want to do this? You're all I've thought about for months. For a while, I didn't see how I could live without you. Even now, I'm not sure how I'll make it. As much as you've meant.
As much as I've meant?
I couldn't have meant much if you're chucking me aside like a piece of garbage.
What's the problem? Wasn't I good enough?
You sure took advantage while it suited you, you dumb fuck. And now that you're tired of me...
Don't say things like that. You know how it was. Both of us were hurting, so we helped each other out.
I'm grateful for that, but you need something better, and it seems like you found it. I just want you to know that I'm happy for you and wishing you the best.
Well, that's damn generous.
You're wishing me the best. Wonder what you'll wish for when Foley finds out. He could feel his heart skip, and all the warm feelings drained away. Let's hope that never happens for your sake as well as mine.
Oh, it'll happen all right. You know how I know?
She glanced at her watch.
Because about 6 o'clock tonight, minute he gets home, I'll have an attack of conscience and fess right up. I'll tell him how shocked and appalled I was when you forced your unwanted sexual attentions on me, and how poor Mary Harrell has no idea you're strutting around with a big old hard-on, rubbing up against every woman who walks by.
Oh, don't do that. His tone sounded plaintive, even to his own ears.
Why not? I gotta protect myself.
He's not going to believe you. Why would he take your word for anything? God only knows how many guys you've screwed. Violet picked up her wine and flung it in his face, then tossed the glass aside. It hit the floor, bounced once, and smashed. She took up her purse and walked out without looking back. Winston turned his head, watching her departure. And then his gaze traveled back to the bar, where Jake sat as though shot, his heart pounding at the shock. The jolt of lukewarm red wine had drenched his face and soaked into the front of his shirt. B.W. appeared from the back room. He took one look at Jake, reached for a towel, and passed it across the bar. Jake pressed the towel against his face, wishing he could disappear. Thank God only B.W. and Winston were there to bear witness. Outside, he could hear the engine turn over in Foley's rattle-trap truck. Violet took off with a squeal, throwing up gravel against the underside with a rapid rat-a-tat-tat. He could feel the panic mount his frame. Surely she wouldn't do anything so dangerous as to tell Foley about him. He knew she was furious, but she'd taken it the wrong way. He wasn't rejecting her, he was setting her free. He looked up as Tom Paget appeared in the door. Tom was staring back over his shoulder, the light glinting off his glasses. He brought his gaze around to the scene in front of him. Jake's shirt soaked, Winston drunk, B.W. behind the bar looking rooted in place.
What the hell is going on?
Jake tried calling Violet twice on Thursday afternoon, but the phone rang and rang, apparently to an empty house. The third time he called, Foley Sullivan picked up, and Jake returned the handset to the cradle without saying a word. He spent Thursday evening at the hospital with Mary Harrell, which he hadn't meant to do, but she seemed so pleased and grateful to see him, he nearly convinced himself that he'd done it for her. In truth, he was too anxious to stay home. A whisper of fear had settled in his gut. Violet was reckless, and he wouldn't put it past her to bring the roof down around her head if she thought she was getting even with him. He felt safe in Mary Harrell's company, as though, in looking after her, he could look after himself. Or maybe it was more accurate to say that by staying at her side, he hoped to ward off the disaster that was heading his way. He called Friday at lunchtime, but again there was no answer. He drove through Serena Station looking for any sign of her. He ran an errand in Silas and then swung back through town, parked across the street from the post office, so he could pick up his mail. Miraculously, he spotted her, driving the brand new Chevrolet he'd seen in Chet Kramer's showroom. He was just crossing the street when she slowed to a stop. She leaned over and waited until he was even with the open window.
"So, what do you think?"
She looked radiant. Gone was the dark rage, and in its place was a Violet Sullivan as tickled as a kid with a shiny new bike. He found himself smiling.
"Where'd you get that? It's pretty slick."
"It's mine. Foley bought it for me."
"Bought it? I thought Foley was broke."
"Oh, he has his little ways. He must have pulled a fast one on Chet because he went off this morning before 9, came home an hour later, and parked this little beauty at the curb."
"What's the occasion?"
"Who needs an occasion? He's nuts about me. Of course it doesn't hurt that he went berserk last night and tore the house apart. My brand new lace curtains ended up in the trash. Where are you off to? You want a ride around the block?"
"Nah, I got things to take care of. Maybe another time," he said. He noticed a pair of white cardboard glasses sitting on the front seat.
"Those your sunglasses?"
She glanced down.
"No, what, these?"
She picked them up and put them on. "I took Daisy and Liza Mellencamp to that 3D movie this afternoon. Buona Devil. Daisy's going to have nightmares for a month."
"Kids will do that," he said mildly.
"Anyway, I gotta be someplace, so I better let you go. Ta-ta," she said.
She put her foot on the gas and took off. He'd never seen her so cheerful or so full of goodwill. He returned to his car with an overwhelming sense of relief. Maybe everything was okay and he could breathe again. He went back to the hospital late that afternoon, feeling lighter than he had in months. It was not quite 5 o'clock, but the dinner carts were already in the hall. He'd sit with her through dinner and spend the evening with her until she was settled in for the night. He'd bought Mary Harrell a little houseplant to keep beside her bed. The gal at the florist's shop had wrapped it in a high cone of green tissue paper with a bright purple bow. Jake thought she'd be pleased to have something colorful to look at. He got on the elevator and went up to the second floor. As the doors opened, he stopped in his tracks. Mary Harrell's father was standing in the hall, his face stony. Something had happened to Mary Harrell. Maybe she'd taken a turn for the worse. Maybe she was dead. Cold seeped up from the floor and climbed his frame. Harrell held a Bible in one hand, and in the other he clutched a piece of pink notepaper covered with a slanting scrawl of black ink.
"You son of a bitch! Tell me on this Bible you never lusted in your heart! Tell me you never lain with Violet Sullivan, and don't you lie! My poor girl, my only girl, she's in there dying as we speak. She probably doesn't have but a week to live. So you tell me you didn't put that pecker of yours in that vile whore's mouth. Swear on this book! This isn't the first time you've done this, son. You think I don't know that? Word gets around, and I heard about every single one of your affairs. You thought you were being sly, but you never fooled me. I could barely stand to look you in the eye, but I kept hush for Mary Harrell's sake. I should have said something years ago, but she worshipped you, worshipped the ground you walked on. You're a failure. You're worthless. You can't even manage to earn a decent wage. Weren't for me, you'd be on welfare. And now there you are, off in some bar making a public display of yourself."
Harrell lost his momentum. His voice broke, and the pink notepaper shook in his trembling hand. He sobbed once, and then gathered himself again.
If I had the strength, I would choke the life out of you. My beautiful girl, she's the soul of goodness. And what of you, sir? You are low-down, stinking trash. You've made her an object of pity in this town, and she'll go to the grave looking like a fool. But there's worse in store for you. I can promise you that.
Jake's mind went blank. He was speechless with horror. What had she done? What in God's name had Violet Sullivan gone and done? Chapter 22. The three of us drove to Daisy's in separate cars, like a very short motorcade. Having warned them, I peeled off at Broadway and made a stop at J.C. Penney, where I bought a cotton nightie, two T-shirts, and cheap underwear. I made a second stop at a nearby drugstore and bought three paperback novels, shampoo, conditioner, and deodorant, figuring if I was in town for any length of time, I might as well smell good. Even if the Bel Air was magically unearthed and I went home the next day, the purchases would be useful. It's not like the underpants were stamped with a sell-by date. I reached Daisy's house at 8 o'clock, when the autumn dark had finally settled and the streetlights had come on. She'd left the garage door open, so I pulled my car in, locked it, and triggered the automatic door device as I emerged. Once in the house, I found Tanny stretched out on the living room floor, trying to get the kinks out of her back after a morning of hacking brush, and an afternoon watching cops dig a car out of her lawn. Daisy was in the kitchen brewing a fresh pot of tea. She'd changed out of her work clothes and into her sweats, but she looked just as stressed as she had at the sight. Her face had the pinched look of someone in the throes of a migraine, though she claimed she was fine. The discovery of the car had generated tension in each of us, but our remedies were different. Daisy longed for a bath, and Tanny wanted a drink. For my part, I'd have given anything to be by myself, an impossible desire as things currently stood. I couldn't even take to my bed because Daisy'd brought her cup of tea into the living room and now sat on the couch where I would ultimately sleep. From the floor, Tanny said, "Hey, gang, I don't remember eating dinner unless I missed an episode. Is anybody else hungry? I'm about to eat my own arm." After a brief negotiation, Daisy picked up the phone and ordered a large pizza, which was delivered 30 minutes later. We ate with enthusiasm, though Tanny declined any portion of the pizza that butted up against the anchovies Daisy and I had voted for. Just when I assumed we were done for the day, free to read or watch mindless TV, the telephone rang. Daisy picked up. "Oh, hi, B.W. What's up?" As she listened, I watched her expression change. The color rose in her cheeks, as though controlled by a dimmer switch. "How did that happen?" She closed her eyes, shaking her head at the nature of his response. "I see. No, no, it's not your fault. I understand. I'll be right there." She hung up. "What is it?" I asked. "My father's over at the Blue Moon, and he's drunk on his ass. B.W. wants me to get him out of there before a fight breaks out." "Foley's drunk?" "That's what he says. I'll take care of it. Why don't you two stay here?" "Don't be silly. I'll go. You can't manage by yourself if he's that far gone." Daisy turned to Tanny. "What about you? It's entirely optional." "Count me out. I'll go if you need me, but I'm beat. I gotta get up early and hit the road. We get over to the Moon, I'll end up having a drink, and that'll be it. I'm tempted, but trying to behave myself." "Don't worry about it. We'll be back as soon as we figure out what to do with him." Daisy found her purse and car keys. She said she'd be warm enough in her sweats, but she found a spare jacket for me. The evening was already chilly, and neither of us was sure how long we'd be out. On the 15-mile drive from Santa Maria to Serena Station, she kept shaking her head. "I can't believe it. He's been sober for 34 years, and here we go again." "He must have heard about the car."
"That's what B.W. said.
But why would that set him off?"
"Beats the hell out of me. I don't even want to speculate."
The Blue Moon that Friday night was jammed. Happy hour had ended at 7 o'clock, but the drinking sailed right on. The energy level seemed manic, bespeaking much joy that the work week was done. This time, the place did smell of beer and cigarette smoke. Between the loud talk, the jukebox, and the alcohol-amped laughter, the noise was overwhelming. Foley Sullivan sat at the bar, oblivious to everything, like a man submerged in a deprivation tank. He and his whiskey had been separated for 3 decades. Now, like old lovers, they'd been reunited, and he was busy re-establishing their relationship, leaving no room for anyone or anything else. He sat ramrod straight. His face was still gaunt, but his deep-set eyes were now bright with relief. His was the kind of drunkenness that had him 2 sips away from a blind, flailing rage. Daisy approached, making sure he saw who she was before she laid a hand on his back. She leaned in close in order to make herself heard. "Hey, Dad, how are you doing? I heard you were here." He didn't bother to look at her, but he did raise his voice. "I see you whipped right over to look after me. Well, I'm fine, girl. No need. I can handle myself. Appreciate your concern, but I believe it's misplaced."
What prompted this?
"I guess I was born with a taste for brimstone. You ought to have one yourself. Whiskey will melt the sorrow right out of your soul."
The man on the stool next to Foley's had caught their exchange. I wasn't sure whether he knew Daisy and her father, or simply understood that this wasn't a conversation he wanted to hear. He vacated his place, and Daisy slid onto the stool. Foley had gone back to his contemplation, staring into his glass as though into the dark heart of mankind. When Daisy touched his arm, he seemed surprised that she was still there. The smile he gave her was sweet.
"Hello, sweet pea. Hello, Dad. Could we go outside and talk? I need some fresh air, don't you?"
"Nothing to talk about." That car was the final tie. He made a slicing motion with his hand. "Severed. Just like that. She knew it had cut me to the core if it ever came to light."
"If what came to light?"
"The car. She buried it before she left. I paid and I paid because I loved her and thought she'd be back. Dear God, I wanted her to know she didn't owe me anything."
"What are you talking about?"
He focused on her face.
"They found her Bel Air. I thought you knew."
"Of course I knew. The sheriff's office called me this afternoon."
"Well then, fair enough. We have to accept the fact. Your mother laid it in the ground and then she went off. We have to make our peace with her abandonment."
"She didn't bury it. You can't believe that. How could she manage?"
"Obviously, she had help. Fella she ran off with must have helped dig the hole."
"That doesn't make sense. If she was running off, why wouldn't she take the car with her? If she had no use for it, she could have sold it."
"It was her way of taunting me. The car was my final gift to her, and she rejected it."
"Dad, please stop. You know what's going on. There's a good possibility she's buried down there. That's why they're taking their time, so they won't destroy evidence."
He shook his head, his mouth pulled down as though he regretted having to deliver the news. He wasn't slurring his words, but his brain was operating at half speed, and his concentration was, of necessity, intense. He thumped his chest.
"She's not dead. I'd feel it here if she were."
"I'm not going to argue with you. Can we just get out of here?"
"Sweet pea, you're not responsible for the state I'm in. I'm doing this in deference to your mother, with whom I drank for many years. This is my farewell. I'm giving up all claim. Violet Sullivan is free."
He gestured with his whiskey, toasting his wife before he drank it down. I wasn't sure where his grandiosity was coming from, and I couldn't judge his mood. He seemed dangerous, testy and unpredictable despite the formality of his speech. Daisy shot me a look. Our unspoken pact was to sweet-talk him out of there before he blew.
I put a hand on his shoulder and leaned close. When he realized who I was, he reared back slightly.
So, she's got you here, too?
We're both concerned. It's late, and we thought you might like to finish your drinking at home. His gaze was out of focus, giving him a cross-eyed look.
I don't have whiskey at home. Pastor would disapprove. I live in a church cell that's fit for a monk.
Why don't we go to Daisy's? We can take you out for breakfast, and then we'll stop by her place, or we'll drop you at home.
You've never attended an Al-Anon meeting, have you?
I haven't. That's correct.
This is not your job. It has nothing to do with you.
I don't need to be rescued.
I don't need to be saved. I want to sit and enjoy myself, so leave me be. I absolve you of any responsibility.
He waved a hand airily, absolving me. Out of the corner of my eye, I saw B.W. approaching, and I remember thinking, thank God. He'd had years of experience dealing with Foley drunk. Though both hands were empty, he was clearly in bouncer mode. Jake Ottweiler was two paces behind him. B.W. said,
Foley, I want you out of here.